Africa. Today is Friday, March 5th, and you're listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Coming up, calls for an end to fighting in Ethiopia.
Be honest to prevent further atrocities and human suffering falls squarely on the Ethiopian government's shoulders.
Also ahead, does obesity increase COVID-19 risk?
I think it's really important that countries around the world work together to put into place systematic approaches to both prevent and treat obesity.
Plus, how an avocado farm may threaten Kenya's elephants. These stories and more are next. Our top story today is in Ethiopia, where the U.S. and the United Nations are calling for an end to 4 months of fighting. Thousands are believed to have died, and hundreds of thousands have fled their homes amid fear from aid groups that people are starving to death. In recent weeks, evidence has mounted of mass atrocities committed against the civilian population during fighting. Ethiopian government troops under Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed have been battling alongside Eritrean forces and Amhara ethnic forces against the Tigray People's Liberation Front rebels. All sides have been accused of atrocities, but in recent weeks, numerous reports have emerged showing evidence that Eritrea's military, the Amhara forces, and Ethiopian government troops have carried out numerous massacres. In a statement, Ethiopia's government says it's investigating, quote, credible allegations of atrocities and serious human rights abuses, end quote, in Tigray. U.S. Ambassador to the UN, Linda Thomas-Greenfield, is calling on ethnic Amhara militias and Eritrean military forces to pull out of Tigray.
The United States is alarmed by the humanitarian and human rights situation in Ethiopia. What's happening in Ethiopia has had and will continue to have devastating consequences for thousands of innocent people, and it poses a direct threat to regional peace and security. We need to address it immediately. Be honest to prevent further atrocities and human suffering falls squarely on the Ethiopian government's shoulders. We urge the Ethiopian government to support an immediate end to the fighting in Tigray. And to that end, the prompt withdrawal of Eritrean forces and Amhara regional forces from Tigray are essential steps. And we urge the broader region to work fast and together toward a peaceful solution.
She's also calling on the international community to step up its response to the conflict.
To that end, this week, we have deployed a disaster assistance response team to Ethiopia to lead the scale-up of U.S. government humanitarian assistance. Our goal is to help people affected by the conflict in the Tigray region, and our hope is that others will join us in this urgent, necessary, life-saving effort.
Both the Ethiopian and Eritrean governments deny that Eritrean troops are in Tigray, despite dozens of eyewitness accounts and admissions that Eritreans are there from Tigray's federally appointed regional administration. Earlier on Thursday, the UN said it is, quote, now abundantly clear to all, end quote, that Eritrean troops are operating throughout Tigray. In remarks seen by Reuters, UN aid chief Mark Lowcock told the UN Security Council, quote, Eritrean defense forces must leave Ethiopia and they must not be enabled or permitted to continue their campaign of destruction before they do so, end quote. He continued, quote, countless well-corroborated reports suggest their culpability for atrocities, end quote. UN spokesman Stephane Dujarric said on Thursday that UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres also called on Eritrean troops to leave Tigray. The UN Human Rights Office is calling on Abiy's government to urgently allow independent monitors into Tigray to investigate reports of atrocities. Here's spokeswoman Ravina Shamdasani.
With multiple actors in the conflict, blanket denials and finger pointing, there is a clear need for an objective, independent assessment of these reports. Victims and survivors of these violations must not be denied their rights to the truth and to justice. We urge the government of Ethiopia to grant our office and other independent monitors access to the Tigray region.
Shamdasani says the information they have indicates possible war crimes and crimes against humanity.
A preliminary analysis of the information received indicates that serious violations of international law, possibly amounting to war crimes and crimes against humanity, may have been committed by multiple actors, including the Ethiopian National Defense Forces, the Tigray People's Liberation Front, Eritrean armed forces, and Amhara regional forces and affiliated militia.
She says abuses, including rape and killings, continue, including in the government-held regional capital of Mekele.
The UN Human Rights Office has been receiving information about ongoing fighting across the region, particularly in the center of the Tigray region, as well as incidents of looting. Reliable sources have shared information about killings of 8 protesters by security forces between the 9th and the 10th of February in Adigrat, Mekele, Shire, and Wukro. More than 136 cases of rape have also been reported in hospitals in Mekele, Ader, Adigrat, and Wukro in the east of the Tigray region between December and January, with indications that there are many more such unreported cases.
For more on the Tigray conflict, I reached out to Alamayahu Weldemariam. Weldemariam is a professor of constitutional law at Mekele University in Ethiopia's Tigray region, but he is currently in Boston due to the conflict. Professor, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Jason.
Now, the conflict broke out on November 4th when TPLF forces attacked government military bases in Tigray following a constitutional dispute. It's been 4 months of fighting. We are now seeing international outcry. Why do you think the international community is beginning to speak out so forcefully now?
It's puzzling to me that it took long for the international community to react. One reason why the international community is reacting in the way it does now is by dint of the fact that so many investigative reports are coming out. These reporters, in their nature, are very accusatorial or damning of what is happening in Ethiopia. Mass atrocity crimes are taking place. Mass killings in Aksum, in Edaga Hamus, at the Mariam Church, which was covered by CNN. And those damning reporters, human rights reporters by Human Rights Watch, and lately, very recently, by the Amnesty International. So the international community, so late, made the right call.
And let's look at some of those reports. You mentioned Human Rights Watch. They reported on indiscriminate shelling of urban areas in Tigray, allegedly by Ethiopian government forces. Amnesty International reported that Eritrean troops allegedly killed hundreds of people in the town of Aksum. You also mentioned CNN, which reported on what it says was a massacre by Eritrean troops at a monastery. The Telegraph, which is a British newspaper, reported on a video showing some 40 civilians who were allegedly killed by Ethiopian government troops. Vice News reported on satellite imagery showing destruction of Tigray villages, which suggested what it called ethnic cleansing, allegedly by Eritrean forces. You know, when the fighting began, Abiy's government said it was a limited law enforcement operation targeting some leaders of the TPLF. In light of all these reports of atrocities, how do you assess that claim of a limited law enforcement operation?
Well, Abiy wanted us to believe that it was a limited law enforcement operation. To be more precise, it would have been like a federal intervention into the region based on some constitutional provisions that authorize federal intervention on some grounds. To be honest, you cannot have a surgical operation like the one that Abiy wants us to believe in Tigray, because you are fighting against a region that has been beefing up its security for the past 2 years and a half. The war was inevitable, was pretty much obvious to observers of the region. I have been writing about this since the beginning, that this is going to come. All conditions were satisfied for an armed conflict. So a surgical operation of the kind that Abiy wanted us to believe was impossible, because both parties to the conflict mobilized thousands of forces for a conventional warfare. But after November 28th, that warfare changed into, it morphed into a robust insurgency.
Now, it's important to note, Eritrea has denied its troops committed atrocities and doesn't acknowledge its troops are even in Tigray. Meanwhile, Ethiopia's government says that it's investigating any credible allegations of atrocities and serious human rights abuses. And Ethiopia's Human Rights Commission has investigated other abuses, notably a massacre of hundreds of civilians at Maikadra, which the commission and Amnesty International blamed on a Tigray militia, although media reports have been more mixed as to who is responsible. Do you think Ethiopia's government is credible in terms of investigating allegations against it and its allies, or do you think there needs to be an independent probe, which is what the UN is calling for?
The Ethiopian government cannot be trusted with a task like this, because it's a party to the war itself. So the only credible institution that can do this is a UN-mandated fact-finding mission.
And last of all, what might be next for Ethiopia? There's supposed to be an election coming up this year, although some opposition parties say they won't participate. There has also been mass violence in other parts of the country. What might be next, and what could be done to ensure peace?
I think the first thing to do is to end the hostilities. There needs to be a ceasefire to ease the humanitarian suffering in all parts of the country, including Tigray. And there needs to be a dialogue, a political dialogue. I cannot see an election doing anything good to this country anytime in the future before this conflict is resolved. I think there needs to be a comprehensive national political dialogue to be had among all the political parties. Probably there also might be a need to form a transitional government, because the government that calls itself a government doesn't seem to enjoy the legitimacy that a government needs to have, because a civil war necessarily reflects badly on any government.
That's Alamayehu Weldemariam. He is a professor of constitutional law at Mekelle University in Ethiopia's Tigray region. He is currently in Boston due to the conflict. Professor, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Jason.
Police in Myanmar broke up demonstrations in several places with tear gas and gunfire on Thursday as protesters took to the streets again undeterred by the rising death toll. Reuters' Lucy Fielder reports.
She was wearing a T-shirt that read, "Everything will be okay," as Myanmar police shot her in the head on the bloodiest day yet since last month's coup. Hundreds of people attended the funeral of Angel, a 19-year-old woman, also known as Kyle Sin, in Mandalay on Thursday. Mourners, many of them young like she was, filed past her open coffin, chanting slogans and singing protest songs. Some raised a three-fingered salute of defiance. And protesters returned to the streets undeterred in towns across Myanmar, despite at least 38 deaths, including Angel's on Wednesday. That violence more than doubled the death toll since the military overthrew the elected government of Aung San Suu Kyi on February 1st. On Thursday, police opened fire and used tear gas to break up protests against military rule in Yangon, forcing residents to cower indoors. The United Nations Human Rights Chief, Michelle Bachelet, called on the security forces to halt what she called a vicious crackdown on peaceful protesters. At least 19 Myanmar police officers have crossed over into India, fearing persecution for disobeying orders, a senior Indian police official told Reuters. The European Union on Thursday suspended its support for development projects in Myanmar to avoid giving financial aid to the military. On Friday, the UN Security Council plans to hold a closed session on the crisis.
That was Lucy Fielder of Reuters. The fiancé of slain Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi wants sanctions imposed on the leader that she accuses of murder. That's Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. A U.S. intelligence report implicated him in her fiancé's killing. Reuters' Adam Reed reports.
The fiancé of murdered Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi has told Reuters the world leaders should not maintain relations with Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. Hatice Cengiz labeled Saudi Arabia's de facto ruler, quote, a murderer, after a U.S. intelligence report released on Friday said he had approved the operation to kill or capture Khashoggi, who was a critic of the regime.
We are on the right way to seek justice, and this report will help us in this way. But it is not enough, because without any sanction against the murder, against the whole order of the murder, we can't get any justice.
The Saudi government has denied any involvement by the Crown Prince and rejected the report's findings. Khashoggi was last seen entering the Saudi consulate in Istanbul in October 2018. Turkish officials believe his body was then dismembered and removed. His remains have not been found.
When the report came to release, I felt a relief. And as you know, the report showed us the same thing we have already known, that the UN reporter Agnes Callamard worked very hardly for her report.
While Washington imposed sanctions on some of those involved, it stopped short on implicating the Crown Prince himself. Cengiz said that the decision created a strange dilemma in everyone's minds, but that this could change in the coming days. She added, quote, "The process of seeking justice is a long process. Sometimes it is not easy."
Thanks to Adam Reed of Reuters for that report. This is VOA. Prosecutors in the murder trial of Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin say the white cop had his knee on black man George Floyd's neck for about 9 minutes. It was given as 8 minutes, 46 seconds in an initial criminal complaint. That figure became symbolic in the weeks after Floyd's death in police custody. But filings since then, citing time-stamped police body camera footage, now place it at about 9 minutes. Jury selection in Chauvin's trial begins Monday. Floyd's death sparked massive protests in the U.S. against racism and police brutality. A powerful magnitude 8.1 earthquake has struck in the ocean off New Zealand, prompting thousands of people to evacuate and triggering tsunami warnings across the South Pacific. The quake was the largest in a series of tremors that struck the region over several hours today, including two earlier quakes that registered magnitude 7.4 and 7.3. The quakes triggered warning systems and caused traffic jams and some chaos in New Zealand as people scrambled to get to higher ground. However, they didn't appear to pose a widespread threat to lives or major infrastructure. Listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. The majority of global COVID-19 deaths have been in countries where many people are obese, with coronavirus fatality rates 10 times higher in nations where at least 50% of adults are overweight. That's according to a global study released Thursday. Emma McCarthy of Reuters reports.
The majority of global COVID-19 deaths have been in countries where many people are obese, a worldwide study found on Thursday. With coronavirus fatality rates 10 times higher in nations where at least 50% of adults are overweight. The report, which described a dramatic correlation between countries' COVID-19 death and obesity rates, found that 90% or 2.2 million of the 2.5 million deaths from the pandemic so far were in countries with high levels of obesity. Olivia Barata Cavalcanti is a doctor and director of science and programs at the World Obesity Federation.
So this is not exactly surprising. The surprising part is that governments haven't really acted on obesity until now. So now we have this perfect storm of obesity pandemic and COVID-19 pandemic.
The study analyzed the COVID-19 death figures from Johns Hopkins University in the United States and the World Health Organization's Global Health Observatory data on obesity. Strikingly, the authors said there is no example of a country where people are generally not overweight or obese having high COVID-19 death rates. The report found that in the US and Britain, for example, both COVID-19 death rates and obesity levels were among the highest. John Wilding is a professor of medicine at Britain's University of Liverpool and president of the World Obesity Federation.
I think it's really important that countries around the world work together to put into place systematic approaches to both prevent and treat obesity. This means making changes to food systems, transport systems and providing good healthcare options for people living with obesity so that they can access effective interventions.
Wilding says obesity should be recognised as a key COVID-19 health risk and taken into account in vaccination plans.
That was Reuters' Emma McCarthy. New Zealand's police said Thursday they arrested two people following a threat made against the same mosques that were the scene of a mass murder by a white supremacist nearly 2 years ago. Libby Hogan of Reuters reports.
New Zealand police said on Thursday they have arrested two people following a threat against the mosques that were the scene of a mass murder in Christchurch 2 years ago. Police said an online threat was made earlier this week against the Al Noor Mosque and the Linwood Islamic Centre, which was targeted by a white supremacist in 2019. The attack killed 51 people and was New Zealand's most deadly shooting. No information was given about the threat nor the suspect, and no charges have been laid yet, police said. New Zealand is on heightened alert ahead of the March 15th anniversary of the Christchurch attack.
That was Reuters' Libby Hogan. Women's rights activists in Kenya have welcomed U.S. President Joe Biden's order revoking the ban blocking U.S. funding to women's health organizations that provide abortion or abortion-related services. Critics say the so-called gag rule left women uninformed about safe options to end a pregnancy. Mohammed Yusuf reports from Nairobi.
45-year-old Najma Wangoi lost her sister in 2018 after she bought medicine from a drugstore to induce an abortion, and it led to her death. The mother of two says her sister didn't know there was a better way to undergo an abortion. She didn't know because she bought those medicines for 3,500 shillings. If she knew there was a better place to do a safe abortion, she will still be alive, Wangoi says. She'll have explained her situation to the hospital and she'll have been treated. Under the global gag rule, originally enacted by U.S. President Ronald Reagan and revived by President Donald Trump, it became difficult for millions of women to seek abortion services at health centers receiving U.S. funds. The gag rule blocks U.S. government funding for organizations if they provide abortion services, counseling or referrals. The rule effectively shut down health clinics, as well as community sensitization programs about sexual and reproductive health. Boniface Ushie, researcher with the African Population and Health Research Center, says while the ban has now been lifted by U.S. President Joe Biden, it will not be enough to undo the effects it had on women's health in Africa.
Lifting it is great, but it's going to take a while for the impact of the global gag rule as instituted by Trump to begin to lift. So it's going to require a lot of funding. It's going to require a lot of programs to undo what has been done over the past 4 years.
33-year-old Rose Accord said she's lucky to be alive after taking tablets to abort a baby in 2019. After 3 days of pain, the fetus emerged, but the placenta got stuck in her womb, requiring urgent medical attention. I have a health problem now since I did the abortion because it did not come out well. Accord says, these days my menstruation goes for a month and there's nothing I'm using like family planning. My menstrual period goes on non-stop, she says. Accord, Wangoi and others hope that with the gag rule lifted, more women can be saved from abortion-related deaths and health crises. Mohammed Yusuf for VA News, Nairobi.
The majestic sight of elephants roaming beneath Mount Kilimanjaro has long lured throngs of wildlife lovers to Amboseli National Park on Kenya's border with Tanzania. But the free movement of Amboseli's elephants may be under threat from an avocado farm. Lauren Anthony of Reuters reports.
The impressive sight of elephants roaming beneath Mount Kilimanjaro has long brought wildlife lovers to Amboseli National Park on Kenya's border with Tanzania. But their ability to move freely may be under threat from an unexpected adversary, avocados. Kenyan agricultural company Kili Avo Fresh has farms near Amboseli across some 175 acres of land. Now it's building nurseries with the intention of growing the fruit, whose popularity is growing worldwide due to its high nutritional value. Upset conservationists say the plans and an electric fence on the farm will block the crucial Kimana Wildlife Corridor, where elephants move between three national parks and strangle one of the region's most beloved and important safaris. Samuel Kanki chairs the Amboseli Conservancies Association.
There will be a problem because Amboseli National Park will not have a place where animals can go and graze. The sanctuary will die because it depends on animals from Amboseli. And if that corridor is closed, the sanctuary will die. The way for animals to go to Chulu or Tsavo will be blocked, and that will be a big problem. It will cause a big human-wildlife conflict because they will try to pass through routes inhabited by people. This is what made us bring our land together to create that corridor.
Some 2,000 Amboseli elephants, dozens of other wildlife species, and cows owned by the local Maasai people could be affected by the avocado farm. In a dispute, Kili Avo said it obtained the land legally and then received government approval in mid-2020 to begin work. His shareholder and farm manager, Jeremiah Salash.
It's another source of employment, and it's another source of making their land to have value. So they are very, really happy about the project.
A government agency halted the ordered works on the project last September and said it wanted to revoke earlier decisions that gave it the go-ahead. Kili Avo has challenged that in Kenya's Environmental Tribunal, where its lawyers say the case is pending.
That was Reuters' Lauren Anthony, and that's it for our show today. On behalf of our producer, Tracy Carter, and our editor, Bill Eagle, I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Xinadu 04 will be hosting this evening, and next week, Steve Miller will be back. Thank you so much for listening. Stay safe, stay healthy, and have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States has revoked the designations of Nasrallah, or the Houthis, as a foreign terrorist organization and a specially designated global terrorist. This comes on the heels of the Biden-Harris administration's decision to end its support for the Saudi-led military offensive in Yemen. The war aimed at Houthi rebels, started more than 6 years ago, has led to a humanitarian crisis affecting some 24 million people and to the deaths of more than 233,000. We have listened to warnings from the United Nations, humanitarian groups, and bipartisan members of Congress, among others, that the designations could have a devastating impact on Yemenis' access to basic commodities like food and fuel, explained Secretary of State Antony Blinken in a statement. By focusing on alleviating the humanitarian situation in Yemen, we hope the Yemeni parties can also focus on engaging in dialogue. Nasrallah leaders Abdul Malik al-Houthi, Abd al-Khaliq Badr al-Din al-Houthi, and Abdullah Yahya al-Hakim remain sanctioned. We will continue to closely monitor the activities of Nasrallah and its leaders and are actively identifying additional targets for designation, said Secretary Blinken. The United States will continue to support the implementation of U.N. sanctions imposed on members of Nasrallah, call attention to the group's destabilizing activity, and pressure the group to change its behavior. The United States remains clear-eyed about Nasrallah's malign actions, including taking control of large areas of Yemen by force, attacking U.S. partners in the Gulf, kidnapping and torturing citizens of the United States and many of our allies, diverting humanitarian aid, brutally repressing Yemenis in areas they control, and the deadly attack on December 30th, 2020 in Aden against the cabinet of the legitimate government of Yemen. Nasrallah's actions and intransigence prolong this conflict and exact serious humanitarian costs, declared Secretary Blinken. We remain committed to helping U.S. partners in the Gulf defend themselves, said Secretary Blinken, including against threats arising from Yemen, many of which are carried out with the support of Iran. The United States will redouble its efforts alongside the United Nations and others to end the war itself. We reaffirm our strong belief that there is no military solution to this conflict. We urge all parties to work towards a lasting political solution, said Secretary Blinken, which is the only means to durably end the humanitarian crisis afflicting the people of Yemen.
That was an editorial reflecting the view.